Welcome to the Coin Podcast Network.
Less than 8 months after a stretch of historic and deadly wildfire in the Pacific Northwest, we find ourselves staring down the barrel of another potentially catastrophic fire season. Over the course of several weeks, we're going beyond the headlines to look at the danger ahead this summer and if there needs to be a fundamental change in the way we approach wildfire. For part three of our series, we look south to California to get a better understanding of what happens when wildfire escapes the wilderness and becomes an urban fire disaster. CAL FIRE Battalion Chief John Heggie takes us inside the fight to save homes, neighborhoods, and entire communities. It is Tuesday, May 4th. I'm Ian Costello, and you are listening to Beyond the Headlines on the COIN Podcast Network. John, can you walk me through your life as it applies to fire? Where and when did you fight your first wildlands fire?
I started as a firefighter in 1991 as a volunteer. And that's where I really got my start fighting fire on both, you know, the municipal side and the brush or the forest side. That's where I first got introduced to this profession and been at it ever since. And through my career, I've worked multiple major campaign fires, both locally and statewide. So I've seen fire environment change from when I first started to a aggressive fire that we saw throughout California to a devastating fire that we're seeing now.
Can you give me an idea over your time, over those 30 years now you've been doing this, in the places you're fighting fire, how many more houses there are to deal with?
We've had a huge increase of homes being built on the edge of the wildland. So we call that the wildland urban interface. And as a population grows, the interface grows as well. So we're seeing houses and populations and areas in what we call the backcountry where we didn't see it before. So it adds a complexity to the way we do our job that we have to account for the fire impacting communities sooner, where we may have some more reaction time. Now, any fire that starts has that potential to be impacting a community, you know, within the first day, if not within the first hour. So it changes our tactics. We try to still be extremely aggressive, and we do a good job of keeping 95% of our fires at 10 acres or less. But those big, devastating fires all have been far-reaching in the way that they've affected communities, because let's be honest, those communities are now out stretched into the wildland. And so that's a part that people have to understand and have to deal with and realize that it's no different than living in Florida and being in anticipation of a hurricane. We can't keep hurricanes off the coast. And when large fires get established, they can be devastating. So the public really needs to be prepared and have some ownership of that, in the sense that they need to have an escape plan. They have to have an escape route. They need to be monitoring news outlets or information outlets to be able to understand when they are under an evacuation warning or an order. Reaction time saves lives.
A lot of these developments, maybe 15, 20, 25, 30 years ago, we could be talking about individual or three or four homes. Now we're talking about huge residential developments that come along with 300 and 400 and 500 homes that are fairly tightly packed together. Do you think the people who are moving into those homes have any idea or understand very well the dangers of the environment that they're moving into?
You know, I would say probably 5 years ago, maybe not. But what we've seen in the last few years, especially after last summer, we realized that wildland fires is not something that just happens in the backcountry, that it affects vast amounts of the population, and that we all have to live with fire. We do our best to mitigate it, but we all have an obligation to be prepared for it. The information has been out there, and I think the intelligence of the community as a whole has gotten a lot better. And so I think we've made some strides in that area, in the sense that we've been aggressive with prevention campaigns and letting people know the threat that comes with a fire. And a lot of people have been being very good about being prepared, but we want to make sure we're always pressing that information so that they know when an incident starts, that they have the tools and the knowledge to be able to put themselves in a position of safety.
Let's talk about the fire behavior itself and what you're seeing in terms of the conditions on the ground. As a fire is closing in on a neighborhood and you're arriving there, what is going through your mind? What are the first things that are going through your mind? One is a firefighter and now later in your career as a decision maker.
Yeah, as a firefighter, you know, I heavily relied on my supervision to give me the direction to effectively do my job in a safe manner. And I always, you know, relied on my knowledge of fire behavior as a fireman to, you know, have my escape routes known, make sure that I'm communicating, really have a firm grip of what the fire is doing at all times. And as a supervisor and as a chief officer, I now have a huge responsibility for a vast number of resources and people and personnel and the public. And my job and a lot of what I do is dictated on life safety and ensuring life safety for the public and for my firefighters. So that's really my goal, is to aggressively fight the fire, but always looking for the safest way to do that.
Put me in one of these neighborhoods. Fire is there. Maybe it hasn't started burning down homes yet, but it's become obvious that it's going to. What does it sound like? What does it smell like? What does it make you feel?
It's organized chaos. Through organization, we're able to calm chaos. And we rely on our training, and I simply rely on control objectives. I set control objectives. I develop a plan. I put resources in place to implement the plan. And then I assess those resources and that plan. Is it working effectively? Is it not working? Do I need to change my plans? You know, we have a pretty methodical way of doing things, and it works. The incident command system works. The resources that we have in CAL FIRE are excellent, excellent firefighters. They're well-trained. They're well-prepared. And truthfully, after the last 6 years, they're battle-hardened. They've seen fire. Mm-hmm. They know what to expect, and they're able to implement a plan and deliver on what is expected of them. With that being said, you know, fire is unpredictable. Part of, you know, what you say when you come out, it's complete chaos. The radio is screaming. There's resources coming in, asking for assignments. There's aircraft overhead looking for opportunities for dropping. It's making calm of that chaos. It's developing that plan, implementing that plan, putting the pieces in play to effectively fill the mission of putting the fire out.
In those moments when it's obvious that homes are burning and more are going to start burning soon, what are you most concerned about?
Life safety is my number one concern for the public and for my resources. So that is my concern, is getting people out of the neighborhood if they're staying for some reason or another, and getting people evacuated. They're in the process of trying to flee the incident, and then getting my resources in there to mitigate the incident, and making sure that when they get there, they don't get overcommitted into a position where they're putting themselves at risk. So having a plan and having a safe plan and having a plan that's obtainable is what my goal is. It's an orchestrated event that seems chaotic, but there is a rhythm to it. There is a plan and there is an objective. We stick to the objective and we stick to the plan.
Once this fire starts to burn homes, what changes in the way it behaves? How different is it from the wildlands fire that it may have been, you know, 2 hours or 4 hours or 8 hours ago? How is it behaving differently, and how much more difficult is it to fight?
Homes as a whole are challenging in the sense that, you know, the fuel loading, it can be different. It can, you know, it can be explosive if the home completely becomes involved and starts igniting the home next to it. So it's all really dependent on how the different structures are orientated. Are they close together? Are they far apart? Are they becoming engulfed in fire? Are they just smoldering? There's a lot of variables. Way it changes my tactics is that I've got a heavy fire load. There's a lot of things that can burn. Putting the appropriate amount of resources in there to be able to mitigate that is really what my priority is putting the right tools in the right positions. You know, I like to say I put my aces in the worst places. Putting the right people in there to do an effective job is really what my plan is as I approach a fire that's moved into structures. We do a very good job of defending homes and structures. Defensible space is a key ingredient that not everybody adheres to the defensible space regulations. So people have an obligation themselves to create that space around their home to make it more viable in the unfortunate case of a fire.
Can you get into a situation where you are making a decision on which homes to save and which homes are a loss?
You know, at my level, I'm looking at more of a geographic area. I'm not at the ground level where I'm able to determine, you know, viability of a structure versus a non-viability. I'm looking at a more of a larger subdivision or a geographic area. And they're all viable. We fight for everything. There's nothing that we leave off the table. We make an attempt at everything, but some homes become engulfed with fire before we get there. So there's not a lot we can do. We try to spread the resources to be as effective and efficient as possible. Does that mean we save every home? No. But does it mean we make an effort? Absolutely.
You mentioned this idea of defensible space a minute ago. And just a second ago, you said that some of these homes are burning even before you got there. While a fire is in a neighborhood, can you see evidence that defensible space is protecting homes?
100%. Defensible space gives you the advantage of removing that flammable material from around your structure. If you create that buffer of unburnable material, then the fire has a lot less likely opportunity to have an impact on your house. You know, the more you can do, the better off you're going to be. And I've seen evidence where it wasn't done. And even a low intensity fire can burn a house down. If there's brush that's right up next to the house and it's continuous, the fire can creep and just slowly, like lava, take houses out because they did not do their defensible space clearing.
What's more dangerous, a fire in the wilderness or a fire in a neighborhood?
Oh, I think they all have their inherent dangers. You're asking the difference between a rattlesnake and a king cobra. They're both going to bite you. The complexity of a fire in a neighborhood is you still may have the public that you have to account for. They may have not had the opportunity to evacuate. So that life threat becomes high. And so the complexity of a fire moving through a neighborhood, especially rapidly, like we've seen, obviously, we've seen the devastating incidents that we've had. And those people didn't have an opportunity to evacuate because the fire was moving so fast. And keeping people safe is our number one priority.
When we talk about all these things that can go wrong, John, once these wildland fires turn into urban fire disasters, you don't really have an entire neighborhood you can burn down. So how do you train for them?
We have an excellent training regimen. We deal with the wildland urban interface. It's something that we've been engaged with my whole career. So as far as I can remember back of doing structured defense. So we have a process and we train for it. It's not something that we're unfamiliar with. It's just something that's becoming a lot more relevant with the fire activity and the large scale fires. It's more and more relevant because these fires are getting so big, so quick, and so devastating. It's impacting communities that may have never seen fire, but now they are having to understand that that's a part of their reality and they have to be prepared for it.
Are these types of disasters becoming more common or does it just feel that way?
You know, that's a tough question to answer. Last season was historic, but if you look at the season prior to that, we were fairly quiet as a whole. So they just kind of come and go. It's if you take the totality of the last 10, 15 years, absolutely. I remember as a young firefighter, it was fairly uncommon when you hear of a structure being involved or structure damaged or destroyed, but now it's almost on every incident. So the reality is what we're dealing with is our summers are getting hotter and drier. Our fire seasons are getting longer. The fuel is more volatile because of that extended period of drought. We had a drought for over 10 years. All that dead fuel still is very reactive when a fire gets established and becomes extremely, extremely dangerous. So that's why we're seeing probably an increase in our structures being impacted by these fires.
You've been doing this for 30 years. You've obviously learned a lot along the way.
Yes.
In general, what do you wish people knew better or understood better about fire when it comes into the wildland urban interface?
You know, I think information is key. I think people being receptive to information that we provide and adhering to it. So when evacuation order is given, adhere to it. Don't write it out. Don't feel like a hero that you need to protect your home, because sometimes you may have some great intentions and feel like you can do a lot of work to save what is probably everything you own. But when I have to alter my plan because now you're trapped by fire, that makes it very challenging. And we've seen that time and time again. People don't adhere to the evacuation orders, and then they are calling for assistance because they feel like their lives are threatened. So now, as opposed to worrying about the fire front or my plan, now I'm worrying about saving someone and taking valuable resources away from fighting that fire to go protect or save these people that refuse to leave.
Thank you very much, sir.
Absolutely.
The
The COIN Podcast Network is committed to bringing you comprehensive coverage of the fire season. Check out the Your Weather podcast each week as meteorologists Kelly Bairn and Joseph Dames track current conditions and bring you fire weather updates. Plus, look for special, continued coverage of wildfire season anytime all across the COIN Podcast Network. You can find it on coin.com/podcasts or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Thank you for listening to the COIN Podcast Network. We will talk to you soon.
Hello, COIN 6 News anchor Emily Burris here. We know your mornings are busy, and we want to help you be in the know as you head out the door. That's why the COIN Podcast Network is bringing you a brand new podcast called The Daily Six. Every weekday, we'll bring you the day's six biggest headlines in a quick and concise report, on demand and on your schedule. So check out the COIN Podcast Network on coin.com or have The Daily Six sent directly to you each day by subscribing to the COIN Podcast Network on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.